Hey, CNFers. You know I like a good beer or several, and at times a tasty non-alcoholic beer scratches that itch when I don't feel like getting hung the hell over. If you visit athleticbrewing.com and use the promo code BrendanO20 at checkout, spell my name right, you get a little discount on your first order. I recommend the Free Wave and Athletic Light. I don't get any money, and they're not a sponsor of the show, but I'm an ambassador of sorts. And I just like to celebrate it, this frothy goodness.
Removing pressure from the work or the process is the only way to get anything productive done for me, be it running or baking or writing. I mean, no matter what it is, I think removing feelings of pressure from, you know, because I think this idea of producing a result is challenging for me.
Oh, hey, CNFers, it's the Creative Nonfiction Podcast, a show where I speak to primarily badass writers about the art of telling true stories. I'm Brendan O'Meara. Yep, I'm not angry, I'm just disappointed. Wow, Hanif Abdurraqib is here. This pod is like more than 2 years in the making, man. When Little Devil in America came out, a book that earned Hanif a finalist sticker for the National Book Award, no bigs. We were in contact, then things got busy, then I found out he had this new book, There's Always This Year, on basketball and ascension, published by Random House. It's out this week, depending on when you listen to this. Maybe it's next week, maybe it's last week, I don't know. There's nobody quite like Hanif. His writing is so unique. He's operating on an entirely different frequency than the rest of us. But at least we get to plug into the machine when he drops a brilliant book of this nature about the descension of time, mortality, making it, and the king, LeBron James, himself. So we dig into intentionality, specificity, how he structured the book, sports fandom, and his nod to witnessing. Show notes to this episode and more at brendanomera.com, hey, where you can sign up for my monthly Rage Against the Algorithm newsletter. It's a toe tap and good read. My toes tap. First of the month, no spam. So far as I can tell, you can't beat it. There are several who say you can, and who am I to argue? For now, keep the conversation going on Instagram, or Threads, at Creative Nonfiction Podcast, and consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/CNFpod. And dude, I totally get it. Money's tight, and the joy you get from, say, spending $4 on a coffee drink beverage or a kombucha, or two kombuchas, often is far more gratifying than, say, $4 on your favorite podcast. But if you can, check it out. I just wrapped up a series of office hours, and it was great. I think everybody left with a bit of juice. You guys are working on some really cool things, and it was pretty inspiring for me to hear as well. I'm glad this little podcast that could is a willing co-pilot for you on whatever journey you might be on. Speaking of that, podcast turned 11 this week. I know, right? It's like a preteen now. His voice is starting to squeak. It's kind of cute. Thanks for making this show possible. CNFers. So Hanif can be found on Instagram at Neef Muhammad. I just search it out. I don't feel like spelling it. You can learn more about his books like A Fortune for Your Disaster, some poems, They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us, some essays. He's a man of many obsessions, loves poetry, he's a poet, he loves music, he writes criticism, he loves eating French fries, what's not to love? He has a beautiful voice, and he's a brilliant artist and a generous nurturer of talent and community in his native Columbus, Ohio, home of the Arnold Classic. And it's my great pleasure to welcome Hanif Abdurraqib to the podcast. Riff.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. This time around is It feels like it's a bit more robust, where there is more to do, or more that is, you know, so there's an excitement around this book that I don't think has been present before for the others. And some of that is, you know, Little Devil in America was, you know, everything was virtual for mm-hmm. that. And so to kind of be alive and present and in the world with this one is really exciting. And it's a strange phase to be in, kind of, you know, pretty much in book release month. You know, it's that, you know, very unexpected nature of it, but all exciting.
Yeah. Well, and I think coming out of the pandemic, but also, you know, your last book being a National Book Award finalist, and then, you know, and then you like having the gig with the New Yorker too, like you have a lot of momentum on your side going into this book too, I imagine.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't ever really think about that kind of thing. Yeah. Although I know that it's, you know, I'm aware that it's real, obviously. But yeah, it's not something I spend, because I think I would get too caught up in that. But I also do think there's material results to that, mm-hmm. right? Like I do think that the last book gaining the acclaim that it gained has made it so that this book has some excitement around it. But you know, I feel like if I started to think about that, other than just the material realities of it, I would start to think a lot about the pressures of living up to mm-hmm. What I've done before. And I don't know if that's a fair, that would be hard for me.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, it's funny, kind of an undercurrent of what you're saying too, is like, this is kind of an entry point that I wanted to leap off of. It was, you know, a post, you know, several months ago I had seen on Instagram where you were talking about your revisitation to long distance running. And there's a little clip, if you will, in your post where you wrote, like, what if, and this was big, I stopped caring about hitting mileage goals or pace or anything like that, and just said, I've got 2 hours and I can make it anything I want. And, you know, you kind of go on to basically just say that, what if we just divorce ourselves from like achievement and just go on feel. And I think there's a lot of lessons to be kind of unpacked there when it comes to a writing career too, where you just kind of surrender to what you have in front of you and let that carry you without the externalities, if you will.
Yeah. I mean, I find that removing pressure from the work or the process is the only way to get anything productive done for me, be it running or baking or writing. I mean, no matter what it is, I think removing feelings of pressure from, you know, because I think this idea of producing a result is challenging for me. And mostly I'm in pursuit of an expansive or expanded curiosity about the world or about my obsessions. And I don't think I can get to that if I am thinking, you know, how good of a product am I making? Especially mm-hmm. especially not if I'm thinking that in real time, in the moment of the making. You know, it requires, I think, a bit more thoughtfulness from me and a bit more stillness and slowness in seeing what the process itself is informing me of.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, maybe the curse of let's say like a musician who has like a really good breakout initial album, and then they're almost sometimes always being maybe unfairly compared to that, and then they end up becoming just a cover band of themselves, and
sure.
And that can be I imagine, like as a writer too, if you have like a successful run of books, that you run the risk of just kind of being a cover band of yourself. So yeah, if you can kind of like isolate that and you know, paddock that off, then you can kind of I don't know, you can make forward progress in a way that isn't hampered by past success.
Yeah, and I think, you know, at least in my case, in my situation, pushing myself to evolve and make something different every time, or at least attempt something different every time, to make something unique in stylistically, formally, to take risks, not to leave my work behind, not to leave my past work behind, but to say I have, through my past work, learned how to make something new. I've learned how to challenge myself, and I to make that a material thing, to show up, to really show up on the page as evolution, so that I'm not really, you know, in a way I'm building upon what I've made, but definitely not kind of being the a cover band version of myself. You know, I'm not you know, for example, I know a lot of people really love They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us, and I'm very proud of that book, but that's, you know, I'm not going back there again. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm never going to go back there again, at least not in that way. And I can say the same for every book I've made, I think. You know, we're not going back there again. We're going to perhaps orbit those themes or those curiosities or those obsessions, but they're going to show up in a different way every time. Again, be it formally or in the name of experimentation or shifts in language, all of these opportunities that we have to expand upon our ideas and obsessions, you know, I think we really owe it to them and to those obsessions and ourselves to push beyond what we've known in the past.
Yeah, and given experimentation, I love how you structured, you know, your latest book too, kind of in the vein of a basketball game in four quarters with time ticking down, and in a sense that kind of creates an odd, even though there's no like suspense tension, it created some sort of a tension where you're like, you realize that you're gonna reach some higher note as you're ticking down each quarter, and it really created an energy and a pulse to it that I really, really enjoyed. And I wonder, just like, how did you arrive at that as a sort of structural motif?
Thank you. Yeah, I think that you know, initially it was only going to be in the pregame section. I was just going to play with that in the pregame section, and then, you know, structure the book as it was the rest of the way, just as I would normally. But I really like this idea of reframing for myself what the book was about, quote unquote. You know, I don't think any book is ever about one thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, we do also owe it to ourselves as writers to perhaps do away with the myth of aboutness. Mm-hmm. Or the kind of, you know, I'm about the one, or the book is about the one thing and that's it. The way that I did that, or the way that I felt most comfortable doing that, was by having this time structure built in that reminded me that I'm actually dealing with the descent of time. You know, I'm spending, this book is operating in consideration of a descent of time. And the stakes of that, the stakes of writing in a container like that, where I know going into every section or quarter in this case, what the time constraints are for me, mm-hmm. that also adds a level of pace and pressure. Not bad pressure, but I think good pressure to figuring out for myself what shapes the work is taking for me narratively, and where I can play and where I can kind of, another way to play with time, I think, is to kind of think about brevity of language and propulsion, all of these things that I think could otherwise have been hard for me in a general sense if I were just writing this straight through. Became a lot more interesting to me when I, you know, kind of got to say, okay, I'm going to mess around with this a little bit. I'm going to have some fun with this. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to experiment a bit and think about what it means to slowly say goodbye as the time ticks away very tangibly in front of my face on the page.
That descension of time is very symbolic. It really speaks towards, mortality in terms of life, but also mortality in terms of an athletic career. And so many of the athletes you reference, famous or famous globally or famous locally. And you get a sense that, yeah, it is in fact very, very fleeting. Famously, I forget, it might be Mark Cram who wrote like Athletes Die Twice. And, you know, and you allude to that in a sense where, you know, with LeBron James being, you know, something of a hook in this book of him being homegrown, leaving and coming back and leaving again too.
This book was once a book that in its original form just began as me as a long meditation on LeBron James. But I don't really know if I am looking back or being honest or being thoughtful. That actually was a meditation with very clear limits, it felt like. I could kind of see the limitations of that meditation. And to put an engine in that, so to speak, or to, you know, expand upon it by putting some level of propulsion in it, I had to say, you know, what have I been afraid of facing that is manifesting itself with this kind of obsession with LeBron James's aging? And of course, it was the fact that he and I are similar in age and grew up in the same state at around the same time in the same era. And there is, you know, watching him live and age, even though he is maintaining a level of greatness as he ages, it I think was pushing me to reckon with how short the bridge was getting between me and my a newfound understanding of mortality. Because so much of the talk about LeBron James is about immortality and how he's immortal and, you know, he'll be how he is now forever, because we've gotten so used to watching him be who he is for some of us over two decades, but for, you know, the larger world, just over two decades, but for some of us, well over two decades. I think that I found myself or have found myself at odds with the kind of, you know, the anxieties that a lot of people have with aging perhaps are a bit more material, or some would say shallow perhaps. You know, so many of mine are simply rooted in the reality that I did not expect to survive past a certain age, and then I have. And that is something that I do think is a point of gratitude for sure, but it's also a point of bewilderment for me. I also feel confused about it to some degree. And you know, this book helped me sort through that as well.
You know, if there's a certain age that you, you know, pinpoint that you felt like you might not live past, and you get past that point, how did you metabolize that, you know, that moment to be like, well, now I'm like playing with house money, or like, or am I going to lean in and be like, oh, I didn't think I'd make it to here, but I have, and now I see myself thriving and pushing through that.
For me, it's definitely not the latter. I mean, for me, it was 25. I didn't imagine I would live past 25. I didn't plan for it. I didn't, you know, my impulse was to say, if I am even alive towards the back end of my 24th year, there's a problem. I have not, that means I have not figured out the kind of math I need to figure out in order to exit this place that, you know, for me, for many reasons, in many ways, was purely unlivable, impossible to live in. And, you know, I do think that once you get beyond that, yes, there's gratitude, but there's also, you know, sometimes confusion and sometimes frustration and sometimes a reframing, you reframe the world based off of almost having a second childhood, not in a literal sense, but in a sense that you're starting a life over, you're starting your life 2.0. And that for me has been deeply confusing a lot. It still is confusing now. There's a part of the process of this book that is also steeped in real bewilderment for having made it this far or having made it at all. And then having to ask myself, well, what's next? What do I do next? How do I do these things next? You know, so it is almost like childhood. It's like learning to walk / run. I think this is maybe the book where I've most clearly crystallized that feeling or tried to crystallize that feeling. Because yes, absolutely, it's a point of gratitude to be here, to want to be here. But there's a lot of bewilderment and there's a lot of strangeness in that as well.
Yeah, to piggyback on a childhood 2.0, you know, if your mother and your father were the first parents, and you lost your mother at a very young age, and then you reach, you know, the quarter life point, and then a childhood 2.0. Who might you point to as mentors or parents through that second childhood?
I mean, in a lot of ways, I think I parented myself, or kind of for better or worse, and a lot of times worse. you know, like learning to parent myself in a way, which simply means giving myself blueprints that I can use to survive, that I can kind of not only get from point A to point B, but also just kind of learn my way through all of the things I did not know when I did not want to be here. But I mean, mentors, yeah. I mean, there's an abundance of people I've looked towards. And thankfully, you know, I came up writing, especially in Columbus, at a time when there was an abundance of people to, you know, looked out for me, the writer Scott Woods, the writer William Evans, the writer Rose Smith. You know, I had a lot of people who cared for me, not just cared for the writing I was doing. You know, this is when I hadn't published anything. I was just showing up to open mics, you know, with stuff to read. And these were people who were, you know, thrilled to see me and thrilled to make space for me and all that. And that's, you know, that's kind of, and then I got fortunate that I came into the world of writing at a time where I could look, my peers and mentors weren't people I was only looking up to. I was looking alongside me and seeing people I admired, you know, be it Danez Smith or Sam Sachs or Franny Choi, Eve Ewing, Clint Smith, like this, the list is very long. And these are all people I can still, you know, look to and consider close friends. And there's something about that kind of mentorship where there is no real hierarchy or expectation other than the fact that we care for and will be looking out for each other. And we will set examples for each other when it comes to teaching each other how to navigate this kind of treacherous and exhausting world that we are orbiting together.
Yeah, it's just what comes to mind in hearing you talk about that and talk about peers, you know, your own age and right, you know, just in those circles is the movie Don't Think Twice that was written by Mike Birbiglia about an improv troupe, and like the Keegan-Michael Key character, he breaks off and like he makes it to Saturday Night Live, and the others are the equivalent of it, and the others are kind of left behind, and it kind of really speaks to like the relationships among artists, the jealousies that we sometimes harbor and feel at others and then others at us. And is that something you've experienced too, especially as your profile has been elevated over the last, you know, dozen years or so?
You know, like jealousy?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't know, I guess. Mm-hmm. I think for me, there's a real opportunity to, I think, talk about envy for me personally as a creator, as a writer, talk about envy in a thoughtful way. I sometimes think because there's not a lot of room to discuss envy or how envy lives within us, it presents itself in some displeasing ways.
Right.
And for me, you know, envy is a real sibling to awe, being in awe of someone. For me, that's how it shows up for me, at least. And there's a way that I feel envy for things that I'm not yet capable of or things that I won't be able to achieve. But that envy doesn't push me towards rage or a manifestation of jealousy that turns outward towards the person who I'm in awe of. Now, I know that not all jealousy is due to that, but for me, it is. You know, like I know what writers I love are doing. You know, I actually just finished reading the new Diane Seuss book, and I'm deeply envious of what Diane was able to do with that book, you know? And it turns me back towards gratitude. It turns me back towards a kind of a gratitude that says, I can't believe that I get to be alive at a time that this person is creating something and that I get to be witness to it. Even if I know for sure that I can't achieve what that person's achieving. And that does leave a bit, you know, because there's, I don't know if I would call it competitiveness, but something like that, where I want to be good and I want to be as good as possible. And to know that, you know, there are people pushing boundaries that I don't yet have the ability to see or reach or have access to, that can be a bit, I don't know, maybe a little frustrating or a little heartbreaking in a way, but that never overrides or eclipses the gratitude I have for being able to bear witness to that. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't pay attention. You know, I if there is a level of envy that I have a relationship with, it is definitely the a kind of envy that stems from being in awe of people who are working in a manner that I have not yet figured out how to reach myself yet.
Yeah, it's earlier in my career, if you even want to call it that, I definitely had those burning feelings of resentment at times. And over time, through the primarily doing this show is sort of a manifestation of trying to metabolize that frustration early on. And you start to realize that other people you might envy, you don't get jealous for it. You realize the possibility it affords. Like, oh, okay. Or absolves you of the pressure. Oh, they did that they did that in that way, I don't even have to touch that anymore.
Yeah. I mean, and we're all kind of it. So much of this, so much of, you know, success or whatever people want to call it, you know, it's so arbitrary. There's no, we're not, I mean, at least for me, like, I think a lot of us, I'm not sitting down and aiming to write anything that will win anything.
Right.
Yeah. If I were, I think the work would look different and feel very much, you know, perhaps less honest. And, you know, there's just kind of, we really can't control how our work moves people or how our work sits with people. If I, the reason I kind of don't get caught up in, you know, I really just keep my head down and do the work. You know, I'm not necessarily big on decoration, even, which I suppose is easy to say when you've won things, but, you know, I don't really go to award stuff. I really just kind of keep my head down and do the work. And I think that serves me as well.
I love the degree of specificity that I find so often, you know, in passages in your work. And, you know, of the many notes I took through your latest book, there's one that I found particularly heartbreaking and symbolic, is just of your grandmother sitting on the edge of her bed playing her numbers. And,
yes,
you know, I just loved seeing that, as brutal as it was to experience. And you wrote, like, with enough repetition, anything can become a religion. It doesn't matter if it works or not. It simply matters if a person returns. And that's just so charged and loaded with so much energy in such a tight, compact little passage. And I just, how important to you is that degree of specificity that carries that heavy fastball?
Oh, it's vital, because that's what I think separates a narrative that feels like it can be for anyone to a narrative that feels like it could be for you, broad reader, who perhaps has never played numbers or never even known anyone who's played numbers. But that specificity bridges that gap in saying, okay, well, you've known someone who's placed hope into something that has not worked for them. You have maybe placed hope into something that has not worked for you. And so now we're having this real conversation that is no longer about the playing of numbers. That kind of, there's a real vitality there. I think there's a real opportunity to storytell in a way that brings people into the room and make sure that they understand that the language that I'm in pursuit of is serving a purpose. There are songwriters I love who utilize this. I mean, I this is all because I grew up listening to songwriters that I loved, who were attempting to, in their work, present a reality that could be potentially your reality or a reality you knew. Say, like, Free Fallin' by Tom Petty, right? The engine of that song is not necessarily that you, listener, love a woman or have loved a woman, but it's like you could have. I've never had any kind of romantic, I've never had any kind of romantic turning towards, an Elvis-loving Christian horse girl, you know? But through the kind of articulation of anguish and longing in that song, I began to think, I've known a girl like this. Maybe I've lost a girl like this. Maybe I miss a girl like this right now, today. Doesn't matter if it's true or not. It matters if it's effective. And so that scene with my grandmother on the edge of the bed playing numbers, it's not really trying to get at, have you, reader, ever played the lottery? It's trying to get at, have you, reader, ever believed in something that has not come through for you and yet you return to it time and time again? Which is both, I think, a romantic pursuit and also kind of defines the relationship with sports fandom.
100%. Yeah. It really struck me as, especially, you know, watching how you articulate how painful it was, like, if she got, like, the first three numbers right. And to me, that's like, to bring it back to LeBron, like, that's LeBron in 07 dragging that team to the finals. And it's like, you got almost all the numbers, like, ahead of schedule with a team that had no business being in the finals against, I think, the Spurs at that time. And and it's like, you got the numbers, and then it just gets, then you just get crushed. Like, it is sport. It is sport fanaticism, like, in,
yeah,
right there.
It's sport. It's love. I mean, I think there's something about, I think personally, well, maybe I don't like to speak broadly for the human condition, but I do think there's maybe something about the human condition that pursues an ability to be crushed, because the other outcome is potentially magical in a way. To say submit oneself to a romantic relationship, to submit oneself to romance, is to do so knowing that the good money is actually on the fact that it will one day end, either by an emotional severing between the two, or by one of the two no longer living. So the good money is on entering a romantic relationship, knowing that the chances are that it will end in heartbreak, and not just that it will end in heartbreak, but the reality of it is that it will exact heartbreak upon you as you move through it. But that does not, for me at least, that does not make the reward of loving, having loved, having been loved, being loved, does not diminish those rewards. That's also the material, that's also the lottery number, that's also the sports fandom, that's the whole, that is a large part of the human condition, I think, is submitting oneself to, you know, these potential bouts with anguish, because the alternative is emptiness.
Yeah, and it kind of gets to just the, this is just my interpretation off the cuff of even just the main title of the book, that There's Always This Year, and not looking to the next year as a play on There's Always Next Year, which is something as like as an off-suffering Boston Red Sox fan before they won. I grew up in southeastern Massachusetts as a suffering Massachusetts fan of everything. We've since had a great turn of fortune in the last 25 years. But this notion of There's Always This Year, it kind of grounds you in the present, for better, for worse, for pain or joy. It keeps you there, you know, in the moment and grounded, I think.
For sure. Yeah. Well, and it kind of adds an urgency to the belief, right? We are believing the good thing is coming now. You know, we are no longer waiting for the good thing. We are manifesting the good thing, which that too, you know, my pals do that all the time. Who among us does not manifest with, whether it's intentional manifestation, or, you know, it is manifestation in the sense of wishing or saying a prayer. Who among us does not manifest with some urgency? Well, I know that in sports fans are so funny, and I am among them, so I'm including myself in this language, because I think our tendency as sports fans is to give up as quickly as possible to save ourselves from any impending heartbreak. One of my, now granted, the Eagles did lose in the playoffs, but one of my absolute favorite tweets in the world, that I sports tweets in the world. Who was it? Was it Lindsay Zolads? I think Lindsay Zolads, who's a writer that I enjoy reading, and apparently an Eagles fan. I did not know she was an Eagles fan until the night the Eagles were in the playoffs. I forgot who they were playing. I don't know if all the NFL as much. Do you remember who the Eagles lost to in the playoffs?
Oh gosh, I should know this. My wife's an Eagles fan. I don't know. Let me look that up real quick. But yeah, continue with your thought, but I'll find the team right now.
Whomever they lost to, they were playing, and Lindsay had this tweet that said, "Go Birds." And then 5 minutes later, underneath that, there was another tweet in the thread that just read, "It's over." And I laughed really hard at that. I screenshot it and show it to all my friends. And I laughed, and we laugh about it. And then all of us who are sports fans are like, yeah, but I'd be like that too. You know what I mean? Like, I'm kind of like that too. You know, last night I was watching I'm a massive Timberwolves fan. Last night I was watching the Timberwolves, and I was like, oh, they're playing the Grizzlies. You know, Grizzlies are, you know, their roster is diminished. They're, you know, there's nobody who's on the floor. They hang with this team with number one in the West. And the Grizzlies got out to like a 7-0 run. And I was like, I'm going to watch something else. I mean, seven points. You know, they're up by 7 points in like the first quarter. And I'm like, well, what else is on? You know? And so there is something about the sports fan trying to delay bearing witness to the anguish that we believe is coming for us. The Timberwolves ended up winning handily, or somewhat handily, by the way. But, you know, to say I would rather not be in pain tonight watching this team I love, I would rather not be witness to this heartbreak, and instead I will seek out something else. We all do that way too early in sport, and I think that we perhaps owe it to ourselves in life to, you know, if that is going to happen in sport, and I know that it will, you know, I think that we can maybe be a little bit more urgent in life. And so there's always this year to see that manifestation for the Cavs, to see them operating against what was believed about them at that time, was really wonderful, I thought.
And the Eagles lost to the Buccaneers. That's right. Baker Mayfield and the Buccaneers.
To Baker Mayfield. It's so funny. I used to be a very big NFL fan, and then I kind of, you know, like a lot of people, I just kind of divested around a certain time. And I remember it was like before the Kaepernick protests, but right before it. But I was a lifelong Bengals fan, like a very serious Bengals fan, you know, a couple games a year, all the time, all that stuff. And they were always so heartbreaking. and then when I stopped watching, it was like, wait a minute. I remember the year they made the Super Bowl, and I hadn't been paying attention at all. And someone was like, yo, the Bengals are in the Super Bowl. I was like, get the fuck out of here. There's no way. You know, like last time I saw the Bengals, they were like losing in the first round of the playoffs every single year. So, you know, it's one of those things where I thought, you know, because another thing I think sports fans do is we become a bit self-centered, I think, where it's like, I was the curse, you know?
Yeah, because I feel like, did they in the 90s draft Kajana Carter out of Penn State? And
they did draft Kajana Carter.
Blew out his knees or something. Then Carson Palmer, he rips up his ACL. It's like, oh my God, this is like a cursed franchise.
And then they had Andy Dalton had that great year. There was a year Andy Dalton just had a phenomenal year, and then he got hurt, like right when it was time to go to the playoffs, or maybe in the playoffs he got hurt. So it's, you know, for part of my divesting from football was, sure, you know, there were like moral, logical reasons or whatever. But some of it was also like, I can only suffer, you know, I'm a Timberwolves fan, I'm a Newcastle supporter. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like, I can only suffer on so many fronts, you know? Right. And if this is the one that it's easiest to go away from, then this will be the one.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, speaking of like lottery ticket, it's just like having grown up a New England fan of everything. And then, you know, we get Tom Brady and that Belichick run. I remember watching a game. You talk about like teams like the Jets and the Bills, who are just like, if the Patriots go up 10-0 in the first 10 minutes, they're like, this game's over. This is done.
Yeah.
Or even worse, if they're winning by 10 points with like 5 minutes to go, they're like, ah, shit, this game's done. Brady's going to come back.
Yeah.
And I remember watching a game with a Bills fan at a bar in upstate New York in Saratoga Springs. And it's just like the Bills were kicking their ass on a Monday night. And then slowly, like, Brady's just picking them off. And then sure enough, in the final 10 seconds, he just rips his heart out, and I just watched him slump over. I'm sitting there the whole time just thinking, like, just give him time. Brady's gonna, he's gonna do this. And it's something like, as a Boston fans of anything, just we're used to the ball going through Buckner's legs. We're not used to having an assassin like that. And we had it for a while, and it was like, this is nice. I like this jacket.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, those are perhaps the worst kind of losses to witness, I think, or to be party to if you are a fan. The losses that come, you know, I'd rather just a blowout. I'd rather just kind of, you know, I can deal a lot easier with a blowout than I can this kind of gradual, where you know that the loss is coming, and then in the fourth quarter or the final minute of the soccer match, it just happens. There's a certainty that I'm after. I think about this too in my writing, where it's like, yes, in my writing, I would rather drag you along and then at the last minute offer you something different. But that's a different experience, I think, on the page than it is while rooting for a club.
Getting back to a moment in the book too, you know, when LeBron's decision is so forth, he goes to Miami, and you know, people are burning jerseys and stuff of that nature, mm-hmm. and then you're witness to one person who was about to throw his LeBron jersey like in the fire, and then he holds it. He's just like, maybe he'll be back. And yeah. I love that moment of like that. There's that belief that, you know, that maybe he'll come back. Maybe he'll win, and he'll bring that championship ethic back here. And that was such a wonderful moment.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, I think that was, I really do think that this is my most romantic book, right? I felt that this was the most romantic book that I could write at the time. So I don't know where that sits, but even that impulse feels kind of romantic to me. You know, my pal not wanting to set fire to an old LeBron James jersey, even though he was angry at the time, even though he was like, I can't believe he left us behind. There was something in him that said, but if he came back, I would love him. I would find a way to love him the same.
Yeah.
And that to me is somewhat romantic.
You fold in a lot of just great themes almost, I feel like, seamlessly throughout the whole book, that you seemingly go off on what would look on their surface to maybe be tangents, but they just seem one. And I always get this a slight pulse of grief, especially through your last two books, you know, of your mother's passing when you were, you know, 12 years old or so. And, you know, you write in one moment in your latest book, like, in my dreams, she never spoke, but I would understand the language being passed between us. Every faith has a relationship with the dead. And, you know, you seem to have you always feel the absence of your mother, but you don't linger there too much. And I imagine that's intentional from you.
Yeah. Yeah. I think as I write more books, I think, too, I'm trying to explore the way my grief for the dead, my mother or my friends who I've lost, impacts my relationship with the living, impacts my kind of the urgency with which I love that is due to almost a preemptive grief. You know, I've already imagined the world without all the people I love in it. I often joke, or not joke, I mean, I even write it in this book, actually, and now that I think about it, you know, if there were to be some kind of massive apocalypse of any type, like a Station 11-esque kind of world-ending scenario, I wouldn't want to survive that. One, it doesn't really look, you know, it doesn't really look fun, right. Quite frankly. But also, there would be so much absence and loss that I would not be able to I wouldn't be able to have the will to survive that. Part of the way that I think that I'm growing in writing about loss and grief is by not just inviting people in to bear witness to whatever wounds exist for me, but to say, okay, how do these wounds impact my desire to tap into these grand, urgent affections that I feel for the people I look upon and consider family, friends right now? Because there is a very short bridge between those two realities. You know, I think this book I wrote more about my father than I've ever written in any book, mm-hmm. Or at all. And some of that is because I think I got to practice how to write affectionately through loss. And it's considering, it allows me to consider how to write thoughtfully and affectionately about, you know, a person who's still here, who yes, it's a different relationship. I mean, you know, the reality is my mother died when I was young. And that means, in a lot of ways, our relationship never had a chance to complicate itself a whole lot. It got to really be steeped in affection and now kind of these nostalgic affections. And that's probably not the greatest, you know, you really want to, for me at least, I want to, even the people I love and miss and long for, I want to render them as completely as possible. But it all depends on the point at which you lose someone. If you lose someone before you even are able to fully understand them as a full person, it took me decades to understand my father as a full person, say, and not just a parent. You know, when we are children, or even like people in our teens or 20s or what have you, we still sometimes, I think, look upon our parents as that the relationship dynamic is still what it is, or it can be, depending on your relationship with your parents are, as someone who existed or perhaps still exists to meet your needs, and not as someone who has a full life beyond you and who had a full life before you. And so I, you know, I'm able to write as fluorescently and vibrantly about my mother and her loss because I never encountered the world of her as a full person, which means that our lives never really intertwined in a way that was steeped in complication. My father and I are not so fortunate because of, you know, the different lives that he had to encounter me being on, which were sometimes very troublesome, I think, for both him and me. And so it was good to have a book where I could express a lot of affection and gratitude for him.
Yeah, and the book really starts with that. Just a wonderful, warm description of being at the dinner table and is watching the sweat bead up on his head, or just how you smelled the beard oil, you know, before you saw him coming into a room. And yes, it's probably something that's left in the room as well. You know, this sort of that olfactory presence. And it's I love those little details, but it also speaks to that specificity again, but also it shows an attention to detail where you are kind of giving your father some due there in a way that you were kind of mentioning a moment ago.
Yeah, it's just like a nod to witnessing. You know, it's like, I am able to see you in a different way now than I was before. And in doing that, the way that I was seeing you was much more clarified. It's affection and not just fascination. And, I think that is just also me coming to terms with my own aging and approaching a kind of, so much of this book is trying to kind of roll my mind around mortality and time. And, you know, that was a good, if I am becoming my father in some ways, then I think that it's important for me to at least illuminate the things that I remember really enjoying about him when I was young, because it allows me to have grace for myself.
As you maybe feel yourself surrendering to the gravity of becoming, or you know, closer to maybe who your father is or was in certain, depending on what era you find yourself gravitating towards. What are some of the things that you find that you maybe you bristle against or even embrace in him as you maybe gravitate towards, you know, him in that way?
I think I find myself embracing. I mean, he seems we don't talk a ton now. But he's always seemed to me, and I think one thing that I'm really grateful for that I've taken from him is not only just relentless curiosity, but a comfort with his obsessions and kind of staying in one place, obsession-wise, which doesn't mean that he kind of is stagnant with, you know, but my dad would just pick up instruments and play instruments and learn them because he was curious. And he would spend time with books and records because he was curious about them. He wanted to, you know, in these things that he would be in pursuit of, they wouldn't be like for work or for, you know, they were for him. Mm-hmm. And I think I find that happening with me where, you know, I go down these roads that satisfy me and they operate in a way that please me. And I get to take great pleasure in that. And so, yeah, that's really vital. And to get to see that coming to life, you know, get to see that coming to life for me now is really enjoyable.
And there's I read recently, I think it was in the Columbus Dispatch, where you said in the book you try to deconstruct the reason why, quote, like making it is aligned with the idea of getting out of a place. And, you know, and you said, I've never wanted to leave Columbus. So, you know, what is it about making it, in order to make it, you must leave the nest?
Yeah, well, I think that's a natural, I will say, I think that's a very natural impulse to say, I've been in this place for my whole life for some people, and I am dissatisfied with the results of my being here. And even if, you know, sometimes making it does mean having the means or bravery to exit the place that is familiar to you. I do think leaving and making a life elsewhere is a type of bravery. Or at least I don't think it's without bravery. Mm-hmm. And that said, I also do think staying and making a life for yourself at the place, in the place that chose you, and then choosing it back, that also involves some bravery. And so, you know, I think that I am more interested in the bravery that is familiar in a way, not because I'm uncomfortable with change or what have you, but a part of it is because I love it. I genuinely love it here. And I feel like I have everything, my view on the world is so intensely shaped by the realities of my geography. And the geography that I know and that is comfortable to me, and the geography where I'm not, I don't necessarily feel under pressure to be someone I am maybe not here, which is, that is vital to me. I feel really a lot like, you know, this is just my community. These are my people. These are my folks. And they always have been. And we kind of treat each other that way. And that's really thrilling to me. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't ever feel like I'm lacking or I'm at a disadvantage for feeling like my version of making it almost requires me to make it in a place that I love. I would feel less to me like, quote unquote, making it if I had to go elsewhere to a place I maybe didn't love as much in order to do it. But that's just me. I think that everyone has their own realities when it comes to what it means to make it.
Yeah, I think it would break my heart if you like moved to Brooklyn or take your talents to Brooklyn.
Yeah.
You know,
I don't think.
Yeah.
That's probably not going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, that's you know, I was lucky yesterday, just serendipitous timing, that I listened to Harvilla's latest episode on Tracy Chapman for his 60 songs that explain the 90s, and I had no idea that you were going to be his talk guest for that. I was like, oh sweet, this is amazing, and what a great conversation you guys had about Tracy Chapman, and you brought in Toni Morrison too as just great observationists and writers, even in taking in Chapman's intentionality of just not even being a lyricist, but just her writerness, and maybe just kind of maybe articulate what the brilliance of her as a writer and how maybe that's informed, you know, your take on words.
Yeah, well, I mean, Chapman, yeah, she's one of the great narrators, I think, and just kind of, you know, I think about all of her works like almost like novels, you know, song by song, even, you know, there's perspective shifts. There's volta that takes place in a song like Across the Wall, you know, that kind of thing, where there's kind of, or Behind the Wall, I'm sorry. There's kind of this urgency that all revolves around pace. She controls pace so well, you know, I feel really lucky to have gotten to witness her work early, you know, because in my house, she was, you know, there were fans of her in my house. And it was the first time that I remember feeling like work was coming, like music was coming to life in a way, that informed me through storytelling, through all this stuff. And so, yeah, I mean, I have a lot of value. I think about her almost as a novelist, you know, I think about her as someone who sits back and observes and then renders a world for all of us.
Yeah, and I loved when you were speaking with Rob also about assuming intentionality, that if someone, for example, spelled something a certain way on the page, you assume intentionality, that it wasn't a mistake, that it was intentional. I keep repeating that word. It's just for you, how did you lock into that as an idea that you know, that you do have to be so, you know, very deliberate, and that you assume that from others, but you also pressure yourself to be as intentional as possible?
Well, I think for me, some of it just comes with working with young writers. You know, I spend a lot of time working with high school writers here in Columbus, and you know, it's important for them to be taken seriously in their work. And the writers I'm working with are, you know, a lot of young Black writers who are operating, you know, their storytelling relies on uses of language that are definitely translatable and understandable to me, but that, like, say, a teacher or an elder might try to correct out of them. But so it is important to assume intentionality just for the sake of restoring a level of humanity to the people who are creating. And if I'm wrong, you know, if it comes down and it's like, oh, you did not mean to do that, then we'll adjust it. But I don't ever want to tell someone this is wrong or this word doesn't fit here, because to them it might. And to be into also demand that kind of intentionality out of myself on the page means that I'm teaching people how to read me. I'm teaching people through a body of work how to understand the way that I talk and think about the world and the language I use and all of these things. I'm really encouraging people to believe that I know what I'm doing, which is important for me because I don't have the same kind of background that a lot of other writers have in terms of, you know, education or even experience or any of these things.
Was that ever an insecurity that you had to get over, that you're coming up through, let's say, just a non-traditional track of writerly, of publication and of writerly visibility, that you didn't have that traditional way of moving through this? Was that something that you were self-conscious of ever?
No, I don't really think about it. I mean, I think maybe early on I felt that way, you know, maybe 2011 and 12 when I first started writing poems. I felt like I was just so behind that I could never make anything meaningful. But then I thought, well, if that's the case, then I'll be fine. You know, if that's the case, I'll live. You know, I don't think that I'm existing solely to make something meaningful. At least back then, I was really just trying to learn. You know, I was trying to learn how to write poems specifically. And so, yeah, I mean, and it's certainly nothing I feel now. These are certainly not anxieties I feel now. And there are a lot of writers who exist like this, a lot of working class writers, a lot of writers who, you know, work shifts at a diner like I did and write in there, you know, in the time that is theirs. My mother worked 9 to 5 and then sometimes worked another job on top of that 9 to 5 and would come home and write on her typewriter. So these are the writers that I've known. You know, this is what I understood the writing life to be. And so I mostly just feel like I'm operating in that lineage.
Yeah, of like true like working writers, you know, in a sense where they, you know, they have a public facing life in that sense, and then maybe render it in a Chapmanian way, you know, in a diner booth or up in an alcove at home, you know, pecking away at the typewriter.
For sure, for sure.
Well, very nice. Well, Hanif, I want to be mindful of your time. I'm so glad we were able to extend our conversation a bit here, because this is really wonderful. And this is something I like asking guests at the end of the show. It's just like a recommendation of some kind for the listeners out there. And that can just be anything that you're excited about, a recipe, a brand of socks, whatever. So I just extend that to you, Hanif, as we close down our conversation.
A recommendation. Think that I would simply recommend the making of playlists. I feel like making playlists teaches you so much about both yourself in it. If you start making playlists for other people, which I would encourage that. Yeah, I think that just also enlivens a sense of unselfishness, because you are, you know, maybe sacrificing what you love for what someone else might love. So find someone to make a playlist for and make a playlist for them.
Oh, fantastic. Well, Hanif, this was wonderful. What a pleasure to get to talk shop with you and get to unpack some of the themes of this latest book. So just thank you so much for the work and thank you for the time.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Maybe when the paperback of his book comes out, he can come back and we can drill down on maybe more of the writing practice element of his writerliness. But that was great. Thanks for listening, CNFers. You should totally subscribe to the show if you don't already. If not, yeah, I'm not going to twist your arm. 3.5 weeks to deadline, dude. Had a chat with my first editor and the big editor as well this week, hopefully. Trying to make the most of it, the best of it. In terms of word count, we are down from 167,000 words, yeah, to 153,000 words. Oof. Without losing a whole lot of story, I'm getting the bloat out of it. I'm like halfway through, so I have to at least get to 120,000. Yeah, at that point, we'll start necessitating some very tough decisions. I paid $2,000 to have the book edited, which is kind of a bargain, given how massive and bloated and altogether not fun this rough draft was to read. It's funny. I sometimes never know what to make of feedback. Like, I'm grateful for whatever I can get. It's always a drag when you can tell you're pissing your editor off. Like, when you get comments like, you keep doing this, no, and this is horseshit. And when you hear things like, I didn't think you were going to pull it off. It's on the one hand kind of a compliment, but is it? It means there was massive doubt. Doubt that you should snub out because you've been writing for 20 years and you should know better by now. But then I think, how would I know better? At all my newspaper jobs, nobody ever helped us with our work, aside from like clean up these typos and just get it in on time. My first book didn't have an editor of any kind. It basically just went to the copy editor after submission. You know, so you go on instinct and learning and mimicking from what you've read, and you try your best, even though your best often sucks. Yeah, do I feel good about the book? Not really. Do I feel good about myself? God, no. Self-esteem? Cratered. Self-worth? Tanked. Will to live? Fleeting. But that's being a writer. How much better can you get at this racket after a certain point? I mean, after a certain amount of time, you are who you are, for better or worse, or often worse. I mean, you see with quarterbacks in the NFL all the time, they give them like 2 years, and then they're like, yeah, we kind of know who you are. We know the book on you. You're either here or you're not. You're either a backup or a starter. I've been sleeping like shit, going to the couch at midnight to 1 a.m., reading books that make me feel like a steaming pile of food waste, and then I stare at the blue light of our Simply Safe base station, kicking myself endlessly for disappointing my wife. Like, why hadn't she left me by now? Is anyone's guest? My, you know, disappointing my peers, my editors, for not getting it, man. Like, why can't you see it, dude? And I'm like, maybe because there are haves and have-nots, and you wonder how people have confidence, and you wonder what that must feel like. To believe in yourself, and you can only articulate it, your insecurity and your lack of confidence in the privacy of your own podcast, because if anybody heard you talking about it, they'd stab you in the neck. Who are these people with confidence? And can I have some? No? Okay. It's like what my demented mother, Jerry, told me a year ago, a little more than a year ago, when I wouldn't break her out of her care facility. She shook her head at me and said, "You're not a fighter, you're a Jerry." And I started to cry, and she looked at me in disgust. So that's revising, dude. Stay wild, CNFers, and if you can do, interview. See ya.